Everything you thought you knew about the world is about to change.
Oh! 2 weeks ago, I was just a normal college kid.
Let's get it bumping. Thank you.
And then he showed up.
Hello, Dave.
You are going to be a force for good and a very important sorcerer.
What?
All over the world, dark forces are gathering.
Hello, Balthazar.
You've been chosen to stop them.
Shock!
Let's go train.
I'm gonna give you the basics.
Weapon of choice, plasma bolt.
I got one.
And again.
Oh, I did it.
Something about you seems different.
I'm a sorcerer.
Well, that's new.
This should be a lot of fun. Great men have always been called. This is your calling.
No way.
That's my car. Whoops.
Crazy.
But it is fun.
Now it's my turn.
Every sorcerer needs a nice pair of pointy shoes.
These are old man shoes.
Excuse me?
I love them. A lot.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCriscio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I am doing just great, Mike.
That's great.
How are you?
I am doing swell. I'm doing swell,
wonderful.
Mike. Now, you know, Mike, over the last few years, we've seen Disney find a lot of success with remaking their old animated films and turning them into live-action projects, right?
Yeah.
We reviewed a couple of them, I think, on our other podcast, Film Bookcast. The Jungle Book, Beauty and the Beast, they were massive financial hits, and they've got new ones on the way with The Lion King, Aladdin, Mulan, Dumbo, and more. As a side note, I know several people who think the new Beauty and the Beast is better than the original movie. They're insane, and I hate them.
Wow. Bold claim.
But this whole wave of films really kicked off in earnest in the year 2010, for it was the year that Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland was released and made $1 billion, thanks to being the first major 3D release after Avatar came out. It was scooping up that 3D money
left and right.
What some people may have forgotten, though, is that 2010 saw Disney release another live-action remake of one of their old properties, and it starred none other than our old friend Nicolas Cage, Mike.
Well, how about that?
Yeah. It's like this is a surprise to you that we're about to talk about a movie on our podcast that hopefully you watched.
Mother of God.
It was a movie called The Sorcerer's Apprentice. So for those who don't remember, The Sorcerer's Apprentice is not a full movie, but it is by far the most famous segment of one of their earliest classics, Fantasia. It is the one with Mickey Mouse as the apprentice to Yen Sid, who has to clean up, brings a bunch of rooms to life, and things go horribly awry. I saw like a look of recognition in your face. Did you not realize this was a remake of the old Fantasia segment?
No, we'll get into it.
Okay. Fair enough. There's one segment in the movie that should have tipped you off to that. But
No, that's okay.
Yeah, that segment is about 10 minutes long, completely dialogue-free, and I think one of the best things Disney's ever produced. But how can you make a major blockbuster out of that? You know, maybe because this didn't start out as a Sorcerer's Apprentice remake, that might be
that might have
something to do with it. Actually, Mike, the movie was Nicolas Cage's idea.
What?
Yeah, it was his idea. He really just wanted to make a movie about a mystic world where he had magical powers. and since it was about 2006, 2007 when he had the idea, he was in a position of star power where he could make it happen. And he got his old producer, Jerry Bruckheimer, on board, got his National Treasure director, John Turteltaub, to make the movie, and got Disney to slap the Sorcerer's Apprentice name on it. Now, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, kind of the last big blockbuster that Nicolas Cage has appeared in, at least until we get him in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm hoping. Holding out hope. Takeaway TT, if you're listening.
Which just, I know you are.
Which I know you are. Please get Nicolas Cage to play Jeff Goldblum's brother in Thor 4. I beg of you.
Holy shit.
It's all I want in this world. And anyway, The Sorcerer's Apprentice is not a movie that did particularly well at the box office, which I think had a hand in derailing Cage's mainstream blockbuster career and kind of helped Bruckheimer's box office dominance severely dwindle. He also released another flop, Prince of Persia, at the Sands of Time in that same year. So it was a rough year for Jerry Bruckheimer. On a budget of $150 million, this movie brought in a worldwide total of about $215 million, which is not very good. And in the U.S., I think it made something like 60 to 70 million. Parade Magazine called it the number one flop of the year at the time of its release.
Wow.
It was a big flop. It was a big disaster for Disney. The film starred Nicolas Cage as the sorcerer Balthazar Blake. Amazing name, by the way. Mm-hmm. But the titular sorcerer's apprentice, Dave Stutler, was played by Jay Baruchel, who was mostly known for his supporting roles in films like Tropic Thunder and Knocked Up at that point, but who did have a couple of big hits that year with How to Train Your Dragon and the comedy She's Out of My League. You remember that movie, Mike?
I do actually remember that
movie.
Yeah,
that was kind of a big movie for like a month or so. That was like, yeah, it was a big, kind of a big comedy.
It did okay.
It did okay. I feel like I remember hearing a lot of really positive things about it at the time. Like, people were really into it.
Yeah.
The actor who plays the young Dave in the opening flashback scene is Jake Cherry, who is also Ben Stiller's son in the Night of the Museum movies.
Wow, look at that.
Then you've got the great Alfred Molina playing the film's villain Horvath. Of course, he was Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2. He also appeared in Bruckheimer's other film that year, The Prince of Persia. The only thing I remember about The Prince of Persia, because I saw that movie when it was in theaters, the only thing I remember is his delivery of one line. It literally, he has one line in the movie that I still think about to this day.
Wow.
which is after a bunch of ostriches escape from his compound, because he's like an ostrich king or whatever, he shouts, like screams this. Alfred Molina screams this line, "You can't have an ostrich race with only one ostrich."
Wow.
And
that's
some
hashtag deep stuff, man.
True. Maybe we didn't give Prince of Persia enough credit for being a really deep and interesting screenplay.
Yeah.
Now, Teresa Palmer plays Dave's love interest, Becky Barnes, a.k.a. the Winter Soldier. She's been in a few things over the years, but people likely know her best as the lead of the horror movie Lights Out, or as Andrew Garfield's girlfriend in Hacksaw Ridge. And the young Becky in this movie in the flashback sequence in the beginning is played by Peyton List, who's a Disney Channel celebrity now, known for the show Bunked, and she also appeared in Diary of Wimpy Kid 2 and 3. Also of the Diary of Wimpy Kid movies, Robert Capron plays Dave's friend Oliver in the flashback. Also, don't forget Chloe Moretz, who's in Kick-Ass, was also in a Wimpy Kid movie, and the guy who made Astro Boy went on to direct three of them. Diary of a Wimpy Cageverse is growing strong.
It's long and deep, and who knew?
Yeah, who knew that Cage was so deeply connected to the Diary of a Wimpy Kid franchise, Mike? Blows the mind. From there, Toby Kebbell plays Drake Stone. He's known for his work today as Koba from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and he was Dr. Doom in the Fantastic Four reboot. They somehow got Monica Bellucci to be in this as Veronica, Cage's love interest. As a side note as well, I cannot hear her name without thinking about Twin Peaks anymore, where David Lynch, in David Lynch's voice, where he says, "Last night I had a dream about Monica Bellucci again."
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, that's all I can think about when I hear Monica Bellucci now. Alice Krieg plays Morgana Le Fay. She's known for playing the Borg Queen on a few different versions of Star Trek. Finally, Mike, you want to take a guess as to who voiced the narrator in the beginning of the movie?
Oh, man. You know, no.
You don't want to guess? It's a
pretty cool answer. I can't remember what it sounded like, so no.
In an uncredited cameo, Ian fucking McShane in Cocksuckers. He played the narrator of The Sorcerer's Apprentice in this movie. And then a few different writers worked on this movie, including Lawrence Connor and Mark Rosenthal, who get a story credit. They've got such impeccable screenplays to their name, like Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, the Beverly Hillbillies movie from the 90s, and Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
Wow. Crushing it.
Yeah, so it just hits all around. The actual screenplay is credited to Matt Lopez, Doug Miro, and Carl Bernard. Lopez has done movies like Race to Witch Mountain and Bedtime Stories, while Miro and Bernard are known today as the creators of the Netflix series Narcos.
Holy shit. What a twist.
And now for something completely different. they also happen to write the Prince of Persia movie from 2010. weirdly enough. And IMDb actually has them listed as the writers for National Treasure 3, if that's the thing that ever gets made.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's that. And, of course,
the Cage comeback.
The Cage comeback, man. It's happening, man. I'm very excited for it. And, of course, the movie was directed by John Turteltaub 3 years after National Treasure 2 and 3 years before his next project, 2013's Last Vegas, an old people comedy with Michael Douglas, Robert De Niro, Morgan Freeman, and Kevin Klein. And he's currently working on his big blockbuster comeback, actually. He's the director of The Meg, in which Jason Statham fights a giant shark.
Wow.
Have you seen the trailer for The Meg?
Say that again, but slower.
Jason Statham fights a giant shark.
Nice.
Or a megalodon, as it's known in the movie. Yeah.
In the industry.
In the industry. In the shark industry, they're known as a megalodon. Now, Mike, do you want to know why The Sorcerer's Apprentice did so poorly? Because I can tell you why.
You know, I have a feeling you're going to tell me either way.
Okay.
But yes,
so
I do.
So you're saying you don't want
to
know.
That's not what I said.
I don't have to tell you if you don't want
me
to tell
you.
No,
tell me, Mike.
Okay,
don't
tell
be like that.
Well, it might have had something to do with the other movie that opened up that weekend. Sure, you could have gone to see the limited release run of Fred the Movie, which is a thing that happened that we as a culture have collectively decided to forget about. But if you were like me, you were at the midnight show for Christopher Nolan's Inception, Mike.
Wow.
This movie opened in the same weekend. It never had a goddamn chance. It was
that
destroyed.
Poor bastard of a movie.
Yeah. For reference, this movie made $215 million worldwide. Inception made like almost $900 million, so it got trounced. It was absolutely annihilated by Inception. And the IMDb plot synopsis for The Sorcerer's Apprentice reads, Master Sorcerer Balthazar Blake must find and train Merlin's descendant to defeat Dark Sorceress Morgana Le Fay. So, Mike, what were your overall thoughts on The Sorcerer's Apprentice? You know, we've talked about how this kind of sort of kickstarted the trend of Disney live-action remakes in a way. I mean, Alice in Wonderland was really the big reason. If Alice in Wonderland had never come out and this was the one that started it off, like, we probably wouldn't have the Jungle Book, Beauty and the Beast, stuff like that.
Yeah, still wouldn't be around.
Yeah.
My overall thoughts, though, on Sorcerer's Apprentice or Sorcerer's Apprentice is mostly why? Why? Just why. This is a almost two, I think it's like an hour and 50 minutes or something like that. And it's
just about
too many of them are not good. It feels almost sad to watch it in some sort of retrospect. Like if in wow. when watching it as like now knowing where Cage's career ends up and just Balthazar as a character is very disheveled and dirty looking and sad and all of those things. And just knowing that it's the kind of end of Cage as a blockbuster staple, right?
Right.
And it's the greatest hits of Cage, right? It's Disney. It's Jerry Bruckheimer. It's like he's bringing back all these things where he's not really the star. Like, I mean, he's the star, but well, I guess Jay Baruchel is more of the main protagonist, right? But anyway.
Right. He is the apprentice of the title. That,
yeah, so there is that. But right, it seems like him trying so – it seems like Cage trying so hard to be like, remember me? And then it just failed. And that's kind of it for his career.
Wow. I got to tell you, I had an almost entirely opposite reaction to The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Wow. Okay.
I kind of had some fun with it.
All right. That's fair.
I thought it was an enjoyable time. It's not great. You know, it's definitely not as good as either National Treasure movies.
No.
But I think it's a fun little romp. It's a nice roll in the hay with Nicolas Cage. You know, it's a really enjoyable time, I thought. It's very boilerplate. It's very like paint by numbers. Like it doesn't do anything particularly new or exciting. But I think it just adds a bit of like visual effects heavy blockbuster nonsense. Like I enjoyed it. I think you know Cage is good in it. Jay Baruchel I think is a lot of fun as the lead. I think he's a very unconventional choice to be the lead in a movie like this. Mm-hmm. And I think he and Cage play off each other very well. And Alfred Molina gets to choose some scenery as the bad guy, you know, he's doing some fun stuff. I mean, it's not like nothing was ever going to be as good as Doc Ock. You know, Doc Ock is a masterpiece of the form, as I've said in the past, but you know, I think Alfred Molina is a solid bad guy here. There's the romance in this movie between Baruchel and Palmer, which is just unnecessary. You don't even need it. It's completely irrelevant to anything that happens in the movie.
Yeah.
That to me felt the most studio mandated almost. Like it feels like, all right, this is how we like this is a blockbuster movie, so it has to have this, and this. And it has those things. And it doesn't necessarily bring that much to the table in there. But I think it's a well executed version of this story. I guess, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
And I think as far as the Disney live action remakes go, I feel like I would rather have more movies like this. You know, I would rather have these movies that are more reimagining of something that yes. maybe didn't necessarily have that strong of a story instead of a straight redo of original material. Because I have been pretty open about my, not dislike of Beauty and the Beast, the remake, but mm-hmm. definitely not really a fan of that movie. Particularly because I think the original is so good, and it just, the new one just feels like it's redoing it, but in live action and worse, you know?
Yeah, it's not bringing anything new to that story or to that property or anything.
Right, and so this is taking, you know, this 10-minute segment from Fantasia, which is legit, I think I said it before, one of the best things Disney has ever done. It's amazing. It's a masterwork of animation. Yeah. And this isn't a masterwork of anything, you know, to be fair. But I think, you know, by taking something that doesn't have an actual story surrounding it, and you can just kind of do whatever you want with it, pay homage to that thing, sure, whatever, but, like, you know, you can kind of just take the template of something and create something new out of that, that's more interesting to me than, you know, than whatever Beauty and the Beast was doing or whatever. Like, I like the Jungle Book, but whatever Jungle Book was doing too, you know, I think that's a lot cooler. I think my favorite of these remakes is still Pete's Dragon. I think that's head and shoulders above the rest of these movies.
Wow.
But yeah, what did you think of Nicolas Cage in the movie though, Mike? I mean, you said you felt he was kind of sad in the role.
Well, okay, yeah, I guess I should expand on that. I mean, the character and his, like, the performance is justified, like, the character. Oh my god, I'm stumbling over all my words. Balthazar as a character is sad and, like, down on his luck, sort of, right? You know, he's schlubby, his hair is all greasy and disheveled, he's got his weird-fitting hat that he wears all the time. He just looks weird.
He looks sad. Like Neil Young, honestly. Like, that's,
oh my god, yeah.
He's got the hat, the long hair, and the jacket. He just looks like Neil Young, yeah.
Yeah, he just wants to rock in the free world, Mike. I think Cage is giving a good performance, especially, you know, within this kind of, like, goofy, over-the-top, campy fantasy world we're living in, right, that this movie takes place in. This kind of the thing we have to do where we have to ensure normal people don't know that it's happening. Like, we have that whole fun shtick going on. To go back to, I don't think I finished my thought, but I think the performance isn't sad. I think just that character and, like, what Cage is trying, or what it seems like Cage is trying to do, where he's trying to reinsert himself back into a Disney blockbuster movie, and it doesn't work, and just what Balthazar looks like and his performance makes me sad for Nick Cage, I guess, is what
I mean, this is only, like, 3 years after National Treasure 2. It's only 1 year after G-Force, which...
which, how did that not jumpstart the Cage Assance early?
But, yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I think Cage looks like he's having a lot of fun in the movie, but I think what you're saying is, like, what the character represents, I guess.
Yes.
In terms of Cage's career. Let me ask you this. Had you seen Sorcerer's Apprentice before?
No, I had not.
Okay, neither had I. Did you remember seeing trailers to the movie when it came out?
You know, I don't know if I remember the specific trailers or anything, but I remember this movie and its reputation and, like, all... I remember this movie.
Okay, I remember the movie coming out. I never saw it in theaters. This is the first time I've ever watched it. And I remember kind of wanting to see it when it came out. But again, Inception had just come out, so, like, that was where my mind was at the time. But I did kind of want to see The Sorcerer's Apprentice, but I do remember the trailers fairly well, only because there was one line in the trailer that's in the movie that my brother and I would quote to each other a lot because of just the way Jerry Baruchel delivered the line. Like, I think at that point, we had just watched a lot of Undeclared. Like, Undeclared had just got syndication on IFC, so we watched that entire show and we loved it. And we got, like, really into the Jay Baruchel train, and we were like, yeah, Jay Baruchel's pretty funny. But we also really liked his voice and, like, how just nasally and weird that, like, his voice is.
Yeah.
Like, again, he's an unconventional lead for this kind of movie. And so towards the end of the trailer, there's the bit at the end where Cage hands him the shoes, and Jay Baruchel goes, "Ah, these are old man shoes." And Cage is like, "Excuse me?" And everyone's like, "Oh, I love them." And for whatever reason, my brother and I thought that was really funny, and we would quote that at each other a lot. Like,
oh my god, that's amazing.
"Ah, these are all man shoes," and stuff like that. But I think that does speak to the chemistry that he and Baruchel have together. They're pretty fun to watch, I think. And you know, they have a lot of funny moments. And Baruchel in particular, it's such a weird role. And we'll talk about some of the stuff that goes on when we get to the scenes that stay out to us. But I think one of my favorite things is that, like, he just discovered what music is for, like, the first time, and he's like 20 years old.
Yeah, it's some very odd stuff that, like, I don't, yeah.
Like he doesn't feel like a real person, you know what I mean? He just feels like he's been like living in a basement for 20 years or whatever and then was released into the world.
Yeah, he feels like his character was based on a musical piece that had no dialogue and no actual character backstory.
Well, he's playing Mickey Mouse, Mike. Let's not forget that. He's basically playing Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
But yeah, I will say, I mean, Cage, to his point, like, yeah, they have fun chemistry. I think Cage is a solid mentor role for him. But also, I think Cage is, you know, he's not going off the wall in this movie. He's not going crazy, but I think he's having fun with it. You know, he's doing, there's a couple of like fun line readings that Cage has. One of his first lines at the beginning of the movie is in the flashback sequence in 2000, when little Dave goes into his shop and Cage like says like, "Dave, come here." And the kid's like, "How'd you know my name?" And Cage turns around like, "'Cause I can read minds!" And, and you hear like a musical sting like, "Burn-a-doo!"
It blew into your store. It was just a
coincidence.
Yeah, it was just a coincidence.
I have something I'd like to show you, Dave.
How did you know my name was Dave?
Because I can read minds.
And it was just like out of nowhere. It was pretty great. There was one other moment in the movie also, which later on when Jay Baruchel's like talking, I'm like, "Well, I don't know if I want to go along with this." And like Cage's like, "Well, you're going to die or whatever." And he's like, "Horvath will turn you into like this thing." And he's like, "So unless you want to turn into a pig who just loves physics." Yeah. Just the way he emphasizes loves was pretty great.
Loves.
But I feel like you're about to say something, Mike. I cut you off. What'd you say?
No, I was going to say that I do agree with you. It's as far as Cage having fun, right? It's him. He wanted to be in a movie where he can cast magic, and he gets to do that. And he seems like he's having a blast.
Yeah.
It's basically an hour and 50 minutes of people doing the Kamehameha thing from...
Yep, I wrote down Kamehameha, actually. Yeah,
that's it. That's how we cast magic.
That's in my notes. It's like... I mean, nobody involved with this movie ended up making Doctor Strange 6 years later, but it feels like a proto one for Doctor Strange. You
it
know
really
mean?
Does, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, especially... There's a mirror dimension at one point in this movie, too.
Yeah.
Just like in Doctor Strange.
Which makes sense, you know, Cage... well, I guess he didn't write it, but... There's Becky Barnes and the Mirror Dimension, and we know Cage's long history with Marvel comics.
Yeah, yeah. True. That's just the name Becky Barnes really threw me for a loop.
I definitely started laughing when that name came up.
But anyway, how does this role fit into the roles that we've seen Cage play so far, Mike? What do you think?
So I sort of talked about that earlier, where it feels there's one way to view this movie, like in the death throes or final grasp of Cage trying to maintain his blockbuster stardom in his Disney movies. So that's sort of the way. Maybe I was just feeling bad when I watched this movie. That I took the pessimistic route to view this movie. So that's sort of how I viewed it in the sad demise of you know, National Treasure and all these big action movies and all this stuff, and we get to watch Cage flounder here. Well, he's not floundering in the movie, just where his career goes.
Right. I mean, this is pretty much the last big blockbuster Cage made, like I said. I mean, there is a Ghost Rider 2 coming up in a couple of years, but that's not really a big block. Okay, it's a Marvel comic, but I think the budget on that movie is like $60 million or something. Like, it's not nearly as big as some of these other movies. And it's probably because this movie flopped so hard that he never really you know, went further than that. And it's probably why we never got National Treasure 3 in the first place, too. You know, that's something we've talked about in our National Treasure reviews. Like, it seems so obvious to us that they should make a National Treasure 3. Like, there's... people would see it. Like, people love those movies. But they just never happened. And I think because, you know, Cage's in this movie, John Turteltaub directed this movie, and it flopped at the box office.
Bruckheimer lost his mojo.
Bruckheimer spent a decade making flops. And, yeah, so National Treasure 3 just never got off the ground. I think it is interesting this came out the same year as Kick-Ass, as both movies have Cage acting as a mentor-slash-father figure to a young kid and training them to be like him.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. And there's an interview that I played a little bit during our Kick-Ass discussion with Drew McQueenie from HitFix with Nicolas Cage. And that came up then. It was like, yeah, I doing these movies with these young actors, and like it kind of helps me feel like I'm in the cultural zeitgeist almost. Like, he's kind of in, like, taking part in what's going on right now in the world. And so I think it's interesting that both these movies came out around the same time. There's also a bit in this movie where he transforms himself into a cop. And I swear it's like he walked right off the set of World Trade Center. Like, he has the same accent.
Yeah, he's doing that character. Yeah.
But yeah, so are there, what are the moments or scenes that stood out to you in this movie, Mike? What in The Sorcerer's Apprentice made you chuckle with delight? Made you sigh? Made you roll your eyes? What stood out to you?
I did like the, I'll start small, I guess. I like the recurring Chrysler Building Eagle, just because that was fun.
Right, there is this just recurring gigantic eagle from the Chrysler Building that transports them everywhere. It reminded me of the Abed's Uncontrollable Christmas from Community, the stop motion episode of Community, where there's a recurring joke in that episode where they have a Christmas pterodactyl on just the gigantic robot pterodactyl that picks people up out of a scene, yeah. And that's what this was.
Yep, that's exactly what it was. I did also really enjoy any scene that, oh man, the actor that's Koba, I can't remember his real name.
Toby Kebbell?
Yes. Any scene that he was in, because he was in a different movie, and it was
yes.
It was great. Yeah.
Well, he was basically playing like this David Blaine-esque street magician, right. You know, who's like, I guess he's supposed to be immortal, right? He's like been Horvath's apprentice or whatever for several hundred years, something like that. Like, I feel like that was established.
I might have missed that.
Okay.
I knew he was another evil magician or wizard, right, or whatever, but I didn't realize that they were...
I'm pretty sure what it was that he was hundreds of years old, like Cage and Horvath, but instead of, like, you know, pursuing a life of evil, once Horvath was captured, he just used his magic powers for, you know, to just to get by in life and do, like, crazy shit and, like, be a street magician like David Blaine.
That makes sense.
Yeah, but I did enjoy him a lot. He was pretty funny in the movie.
Yeah, because he's just on full camp villain, yes, which is like goofy and fun.
Yeah, actually, but one of my biggest laughs in the movie is him shouting at Jay Baruchel, "Don't you know who I am?" And Jay Baruchel like responds back with, "Are you in Depeche Mode?" which I thought was a funny joke, but at the same time, it seems like Dave shouldn't be the one making that joke since we've already established he doesn't know any music.
He just discovered what music is 20 minutes earlier into the movie.
And when we say he just discovered what music is, we mean he listened to the same One Republic song over and over and over again. Tell me what you want to hear. Something that will light
those ears. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, I love that he establishes, "I discovered music with the sound of his Tesla coils." Real weird. Right.
Yeah, well, he's playing, like, he does the Tesla thing. He's playing, like, Superstition for, like, a minute.
Yeah, that's right? True.
He does that for a bit, and then it turns into Secrets by One Republic, and it's like, go back to Superstition. What are you doing?
Come on, stop it.
What are you doing? But that One Republic song, I laughed every time it came on. It felt so 2010. Like, it felt so of this era, you know? And not that it dates the movie, but, like, it kind of dates the movie,
yeah.
But I think my other big like soundtrack needle drop laugh was for the opening flashback when it says, like, it's the year 2000 and Jimmy Eat World's The Middle starts playing.
Yeah,
just so we know it's the year 2000.
Yep. Other scene, though, I guess the scene we'll talk about the most probably is the Fantasia scene.
Yes.
Where we recreate that with the dancing mops and the cleanup and everything. Which was hilarious to me, not realizing this movie is based on that scene. So I was just like, all right, sure, we'll do Fantasia, I guess.
Right. So you got that it was doing Fantasia.
Yeah.
You just had no idea that it was supposed to be based on Fantasia.
Yeah. So I thought, I was like, oh, that's cute, Disney. Like, cause, you know, Balthazar tests him with cleaning up the place before he comes back. Right. So he starts to make the mobs dance, and I was like, oh yeah, you're referencing Fantasia, that's like your big thing, good for you, Disney. And then it does the whole scene, and
it goes into it. I mean, and I think the homage is pretty fun, but yeah, if you don't know that it's based on The Sorcerer's Apprentice, I would imagine it just comes out of nowhere.
It was real weird. I thought it was like, oh, that's like, you know, gonna be a quick thing where the mobs dance, and I was like, that's funny. And then it did the whole thing, and I was like, all right, I guess.
Right, 'cause the mobs dance. It even went through the like that big, the shot of Jay Baruchel's shadow like chopping with an axe, right? Like,
yeah.
that like, even that was part of that. But my notes were just like, hey, they're doing the brooms. Look at the shadow. Stuff like that.
They're doing it.
Yeah, they're doing it. Woo! Did you see the post-credit scene?
No.
Okay, there was a post-credit scene. It's like 3 seconds long, but it's Horvath picking up his hat, like he's alive again. And he picks up his hat, but when he picks up his hat, you see Mickey's sorcerer hat from Sorcerer's Apprentice, like, sitting next to it.
Interesting.
So it's like the big tall blue hat with the stars on it. So it does, you know, it, again, this is a Sorcerer's Apprentice remake in, like, name only, really.
Yeah.
you know, other than the fact that it pays homage to the original short for about 5 minutes, completely out of nowhere. Like, it's basically a different movie during that point.
Yeah.
Because it has nothing to do with anything that happens in the movie.
I'm pretty sure it's the same music, too, right? I mean, I would assume, because the whole thing is set... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, or maybe, like, a rework... it is the same music, maybe, like, a reworking of it. Like, I'm not sure if it's the exact same track or anything. But I did think it was, like, a fun little sequence. And you know, as somebody who knew that it was based on The Sorcerer's Apprentice, I got something out of it. So, you know, it was fun. But, yeah, I do have a lot of questions about the Chinatown sequence.
Okay.
Specifically, what happened to those people inside the dragon when it came to life?
It seems kind of like they just became part of the dragon.
Right. That's terrifying.
Yeah, no, that was some, like, Cronenberg body horror shit.
Yeah, because the thing is, like, if they, like, the, you know, the dragon was moving around and stuff, and, like, you know, it was... So what happens is, for those who haven't seen the movie, is, which I'm guessing is most people, they're in Chinatown, and I guess it's, like, Chinese New Year going on or whatever at the same time, or whatever. There's a big celebration going on,
yeah,
right, in Chinatown. And... you know, there's a big, like, kind of Chinese dragon walking through the streets. People are under it and stuff like that, like, pushing the dragon through. And then one of the magicians comes out, starts fighting them, and turns that into a real dragon. And I was all on board. I thought that was awesome. Like, I thought that was a really fun sequence. But then it shows you the inside of the dragon, where the people are still there pushing it, but the dragon's turning into a real dragon around them. And so it's, like, the paper turns into, like, stomach lining and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you can see the people start to, like, look around, like, what's going on? And then you don't see them again until the dragon disappears.
Yeah, it was real weird, because I think they show that, and one of the guys is like, man, this is getting real heavy. And then it turns into, like, stomach. And then you see his feet become the dragon's feet, which was real weird. And then he just, and then, like you said, that once the dragon's defeated, they just are standing in there in, like, a burnt paper shell or something.
Right. But, like, that was terrifying.
So, yeah. Yeah, I assume they're just slowly suffocating inside a dragon's stomach.
Yeah, but I did think that sequence was a lot of fun, though. Like, I had a lot of fun with that sequence. And I feel like the big action sequences in general, I thought were pretty fun and well-executed.
Yeah, yeah, I like that scene. I liked the confetti bit with that, which is the, you know, the conceit that all these magic modern fantasy movies have to do, or, like, urban fantasy. Like, oh, people that don't know about magic can't know about it.
Right.
So, like, we just fill the whole street with confetti. So, like, it looked cool. You know, that was fun. I liked the car chase thing where Korvath turns every car into a yellow cab, right?
And
And then they turn their cars into supercars, and we have, like, a little car chase. That was cool.
Yeah, it's having fun with its magic and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. Also, actually, Cage's car in the movie is also Cage's car in real life. Just throwing that out there.
That's cool.
Yeah, the producers were looking for, like, a classic car to use for the... you know, for the thing. And Cage's like, well, I have one. We can...
Yeah.
I have several, actually, but I can bring one over. And that's what he did. So I think that's kind of cool. But, yeah, I did think there's the bit in the flashback in the opening. So I want to talk a little bit about the romance between Jay Baruchel and Teresa Palmer. Because it is so perfunctory in this movie. What really, like, turned me off immediately was the flashback in the opening where young Dave is scrolling on the window. And he's, like, doing a little King Kong thing, and so it lines up with the Empire State Building, so it looks like King Kong's with the Empire State Building on the window. And I was like, yeah, that's, like, kind of funny. Like, oh, look at Dave. He's a little precocious kid. And then, like, across the bus, you see the little, like, young Becky, young Winter Soldier, and she's, like... and she, like, looks over and is like, oh, that's cool. And I was like, no, it's not. this is dumb. Like, I don't mind that he's doing that in the window. That's fine. It's a fun little character. Like, that's a fun little beat, I guess.
Yeah.
But the fact that she thinks it's so cool, and the fact that she makes, like, a big deal about it, and the movie makes a big deal about the fact that she thinks that's cool, I thought that was dumb. But then later on in the movie, they turn that into a character moment. Like, she even says to him, like, wow, remember when we went on that field trip and, like, you lined up King Kong on the window to the Empire State Building? That was so cool. And I was like, no, it wasn't.
Stop. There's no way you'd remember that as an adult.
And that's the thing. So these two went to school together when they were in, like, fourth grade, right? And then Dave switched schools because of his ridiculous incident in the flashback where he burns down the sorcerer's shop, which, by the way, he sets free Horvath immediately.
Yeah.
Like, he shows up, and within 10 seconds, Horvath is set free. Dave fucked up big time. But anyway, after that whole incident, like, you know, everybody in the class makes fun of him because they think he's lying and they think he peed his pants and all that stuff. So he switches schools. And then it picks up 10 years later to the day.
Yeah.
According to the thing on the screen. And then he, by chance, runs into her again. I guess they go to the same college. by happenstance, right. And they end up like striking up a conversation, and he ends up stalking her, and it's like, oh, this is fun, like fun times like this.
Yeah.
And he gets so hung up on her immediately, and I was so frustrated by that. Like there's the a bit where Cage is telling him not to go to her, and he's like, I don't know, man, I think she's the one, and like, what? You met her like a day ago for the first time in 10 years.
It's real weird. Yeah, that whole relationship is so bizarre, and it feels so much like a studio, like you said, studio mandated, a like, we have to put this in because this is what blockbusters have, and we have to, you know, fucking also play this One Republic song all the time. Tell me what you want to hear.
Well, the excuse is that, you know, she's a radio DJ, right? And like, yeah. Music is her passion. But science is his passion. So they're like polar opposites, but they love each other anyway.
Right brain, left brain. It'll never work, Mike.
Star-crossed, man. Star-crossed. But yeah, so she's like a radio DJ who hosts like a cool radio show with all the underground bands, like One Republic.
Yeah.
That's actually one of my favorite lines in the movie, actually, was when Jay Baruchel comes up to her and is like, yeah, I listened to a radio show. I'd never heard of any of those bands, which is a pretty good indication that they're pretty cool. and I thought that was actually a pretty funny line, because like, that's a funny thing to say, you know. Yeah. But then again, it's like it's just that one song over and over again. It's Secrets by One Republic, in case anyone was wondering. Mm. And it's just the chorus every time. It's like, tell me what you want from me. Or whatever. Tell me what you want to hear or something. And
something
yeah,
like that, yeah. But that relationship, and it's just, you know, that song, it's just so clearly like, you know, 2010 big studio, we got to put this product placement in the thing so we could sell the album so we could have the thing. And it's just like, oh, come on. Come on with this movie.
Yeah, come on with this movie and all. What did you think of the extended homage to Star Wars? there's a bit where Alfred Molina does like...
Yes.
He tries to manipulate the guy and be like, you know, you don't need to look at my papers or whatever. And the guy says, I don't need to look at your papers. And then Drake, and then like it holds on that for a beat. And it's like, okay, it's I'm watching Star Wars. And then Toby Kebbell is like, these are the droids you're looking for. And it's like, okay, like we got it.
Aren't like, jokes better when they're explained though?
Right. But the thing is, like, what bugged me about that joke is that Alfred Molina's character has been trapped in an urn for, you know, hundreds of years. He wouldn't get that reference, but he's still annoyed by it. Like, he still, like, rolls his eyes and be like, oh, he's making a Star Wars reference. And it's like...
Get a load of old Star Wars reference guy.
Yes.
Yeah. I did, like, I thought that was funny, you know, that's, well, up until they just say the line that they're quoting.
Right.
You know, just the way that they're both delivering, I don't need to see your identification papers or whatever it is that, like, the thing they need to see. Sure, why not?
Yeah, and then Disney bought Star Wars 2 years later, so they could just homage it on their own. And they're on their
they could
own
just make another one. Oh,
they
wait.
Could just make a new one. But actually, there was a different one, an extended homage to Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I thought was actually a lot more successful. When Jay Baruchel has to go into Drake's apartment or whatever, I think she's been kidnapped. Teresa Palmer's been kidnapped, and he has to find something, some kind of MacGuffin or whatever. And he looks down like the fireplace or whatever, and he starts doing like the chin thing, like Indiana Jones does when he's about to pick up the idol. And then he picks up the thing that he's supposed to pick up, and then he looks up as if like a boulder's going to fall down, but nothing happens. I thought that was pretty funny.
That was good. I did. Yeah, I guess I didn't put that together, but yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. Nice little Alfred Molina career homage. Sure.
Yes. Yeah. His very first role was a Satipo in Raiders of the Lost Ark. What did you think of the overall like mystical stuff in the movie? Like any of the backstory stuff, Morgana Le Fay, Veronica, any of that work for you?
I mean, it was kind of cool. I like that sort of using folklore, right? Like it's Arthurian legends and stuff like that, right? Merlin
right.
and all that. And moving it, you know, turning it a little bit, moving it into modern day and stuff. That was cool. That was pretty fun. But it did feel weird. I don't know. It was like just seeing Nick Cage and Merlin, like, and all that stuff. I did find the term Prime Merlion to be the funniest thing ever.
I think what made me laugh about that the most is that I had no idea what they were saying the first several times they said it, you know? So it was like, so it was Prime Merlinian was what it was.
Merlinian,
But the first few times, like, they say it a lot in the movie. They say the words Prime Merlinian a lot. But the first, like, 50 times they said it, I just heard Prime Merlinian. You know, like, it just felt like mumbling to me.
Yeah, it felt real, like somebody had heard the phrase Prime Meridian, and they're like, we can do something with that.
Yeah. I do want to talk about the climax a little bit, where the moral of the story is that science is better than magic, which which is a little weird to have in your magic movie. More to the point, though, you know, this movie has Morgana Le Fay, Alice Creed character, getting released. And when she's released, she's possessing Monica Bellucci's character, Veronica. But then what happens is that Cage absorbs her. Like, Cage absorbs her. And we are teased with the possibility of Cage being possessed by Morgana Le Fay and being able to go insane, like full 11 Cage. And yeah. It happens for like a line, and then it disappears. Then it stops.
It was so sad.
It was very disappointing. We were so close to Cage greatness there. Yeah. And it just barely missed the mark. Like, it was a bummer. But did you like the way this all wrapped up? The how Jay Baruchel used the power of physics to to defeat Horvath and Morgana Le Fay?
Not really. I don't know. It hyped up him being the prime Merlinian so much, and that he's, you know, Merlin's descendant, and he's got this latent, crazy, magical power. And then he just, like, fails at magic a bunch of times, and then just electrocutes her. I don't know. It just didn't feel that great. I didn't like that whole sequence, like, once they're in the park, you know, and he's battling Morgana Le Fay with Veronica and everybody. Because that's when it just became people kamehameha-ing at each other.
Right.
And, like, nothing really happening. And up until that point, the magic and action had been pretty inventive, like we talked about, with the car chases and going to the mirror dimension and stuff. And but then it just kind of is people standing in a circle shooting magic bolts at each other, and nothing really happens.
Yeah.
So I felt let down in that climax.
Yeah, I can see that. I would probably agree with you on that one, actually. I think at that point, like, I was probably a little checked out of the movie. I enjoyed it overall, but, like, I was about ready for it to be done. I think overall what I do like about the movie is that it just kind of has, like, I think Jay Baruchel brings, like, this, like, a sarcastic tone to the role, almost. Like, yeah. He's, like, he never seems that surprised that magic exists and that these things are happening to him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it makes, I mean, the way the movie establishes it, like, he saw all this when he was 10, right? And he seemed pretty shocked at that point. But then, you know, 10 years have gone by, and it's kind of established that, like, he went to therapy and stuff, and he's gotten better and stuff like that. But then, like, all this stuff starts happening, and he just rolls with it. He's just, like, he's just in, pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't put up that much of a fight. Like, he says he doesn't want to be part of it for a little bit, but then he's like, well, yeah, I do. you know, the movie ends, he defeats the Horvath, he saved Nicolas Cage, he gets the girl, they ride away on a gigantic fucking eagle, and then it's over.
Yeah, like every boy's dream.
True.
He does all those things.
Very true. So is there anything else you wanted to bring up in the movie, Mike, that we haven't mentioned yet, or should we move on to Netflix reviews?
No, I think that's it. Let's hear what other people have to say.
All right, let's do that. Let's move on to Netflix and Letterboxd reviews for The Sorcerer's Apprentice, starting right now. Here's a 2-star review of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Yes, Nicolas Cage, as usual, he was wonderful. As for the storyline, it was great too. But I gave this movie only 2 stars because it was too violent and loud.
Oh my God.
And in-your-face insane. It all could have been presented successfully without these factions. I think it's downright scary that these type of movies are meant for young children. No, parents, this movie is too violent for children. It's our old friend, man, coming out the
gate. Temperance virgin eyes?
I don't... Yeah, like I said, usually she's upset about the language. This time, it's the violence.
Yeah.
So, yeah, mixing it up a little bit, I guess. Here's a 5-star review of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. To be honest, I was really surprised when I saw Nicolas Cage in a Disney family movie, as I had only ever seen him in The Rock and Ghost Rider. When I got to watching the movie, I was really dragged in by the characters and the special effects. I also love the ending. Unlike those movies where it just ends in a really disappointing cliffhanger, looking at you, video game high school. This one was very well thought of and amazingly scripted. Well done as usual, Disney. I love the random dragging of video game high school in this,
yeah.
in this review.
Cage's only 2 movies, The Rock and Ghost Rider.
Well, now 3 movies, Mike, The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
And
as well.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
It's added to the canon. Here's a 5-star review of The Sorcerer's Apprentice on Letterboxd. This movie really came on Freeform, and I gained the ability to taste time because I thought Nick Cage being a sorcerer was a dream I had. That's the whole review. That's it.
Wow. Interesting.
Here's a 3.5-star review of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I never thought I would say this, But I sort of miss that period in the late 2000s where Cage and Bruckheimer churned out several family-friendly flicks. It was initially strange to see the man who had grabbed a choir girl's ass in Face Off staring in films masterminded by the Mouse House. But I like watching Cage ply his particular set of skills in various genres and for various audiences. And, at the very least, it has given me a way to satisfy my sudden obsession with Nick Cage and also have something to watch with the kids. It's never too early to introduce your kids to the majesty of Nicolas Cage. Get them hooked while they're young. Works for Big Tobacco.
Wow.
Yeah. Here's a 3-star review of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The start of the movie where the kid writes, "Do you want to be my girlfriend?" on a piece of paper and passes it on to the girl, who then writes, "Yes." And then a gust of wind takes the paper into a store, who the kid follows and finds out he's destined to defeat a great evil and then release said evil, is literally my love life.
That poor person.
Yeah, it's rough, man. It's a rough life. It's rough being Jay Baruchel.
Yeah.
And finally, I got one more. Here's a 2.5-star review of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. This is going to be less a review and more a spitting out of my random thoughts about this movie. This movie stars Jay Baruchel as a live-action adult version of his character Hiccup from How to Train Your Dragon. Nicolas Cage doesn't freak out in this movie, but he still acts very cagey, so don't you worry. I'm not kidding. Half a star is knocked off for the script calling it a knuckle bump as opposed to a fist bump.
Wow.
Yeah, it's harsh. Harsh words. Yeah. The magic CGI is pretty bad. In fact, I'd say this would be a great example of how not to do a Doctor Strange movie. Glad they nailed it the second time around. Be right back. I'm going to make a supercut of Jay Baruchel reacting to literally everything. Don't wake up. Don't wait up. Waiting for Disney to make a sequel 10 years later to the day. That would be July 14th, 2020. Finally, if I hear the words Prime Merlinian one more time, someone's going to get hurt.
I appreciate that that person live wrote that, live blogged their review.
Yes. So that wraps up our the Netflix and Letterboxd reviews of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. And I think that about wraps up our thoughts on the movie, Mike. So it seems like I liked it a little more than you did.
Yeah, it seems so.
Yeah, I thought it was a relatively fun, you know, Disney blockbuster. You know, it had its moments. It had its, you know, it definitely had its weak points for sure. But overall, I thought it was solid, and you not so much, and that's fine.
Yeah, not many of those words would I pick.
It's okay. Becky Barnes will return in Avengers 4, probably. Or no, wait, did she get snapped by Thanos? Is that what?
Oh man, spoilers! I don't know. She got snapped by Morgana.
She got snapped by Morgana. Yeah, this movie was actually just Cage collecting the Infinity. In a way, this movie was Cage trying to collect the Infinity Stones, Mike.
Yeah, in the way that every movie is that, you know?
Just in a general sort of way, you know? Now, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me online on Twitter at MSmithFilmBlog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DeCriscio. If you'll see this review of our podcast on iTunes, subscribe, rate, take a moment to give us a review, support this podcast, and Filmbook take part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Now, any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us in 2 weeks for another episode of The Complete Works. And if you did not like Nicolas Cage in a semi-medieval setting for this movie, Mike, well, we're talking Season of the Witch next time. So,
oh, shit.
So I remember that movie coming out. I never saw it. I know that Ron Perlman's in it.
Ooh.
So can't be all bad, right?
Yeah. It's got that going for it.
Yeah, which is nice. Plus, you can keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we're talking Deadpool 2 next week. Very excited to see that movie. I'm seeing that tomorrow night, actually, as of this recording. I've heard great things. I've heard that it has the best post-credits scene of all time. I've seen,
oh my God,
many critics. I've seen many critics say that it's like arguably the best post-credits scene ever. And I'm sure the movie's pretty good, too. So, looking forward to it. Thank you so much for listening, guys. And thanks for getting in the cage. So tell me what you want to hear.